Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Next Wednesday is the 50th anniversary of the legendary March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Interesting timing, just after the Supreme Court upended a centerpiece of the Voting Rights Act and a federal court in New York decided the NYPD is racially discriminating in the way it stops and frisks. We are not at the end of history. But let's talk a little bit about where we are and where we were with Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of King and civil rights historian. His latest book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Hi, Taylor. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Nice to be back, Brian.
There are so many places we could start, but you've written about how white officials and the news media anticipated race riots or worse at that march on Washington, August 28th, 1963. Was there a lot of public anticipation of this march as a big deal?
Absolutely. But we tend to misremember things when they're involved with race, we want to think of it as different than it was. There was tremendous fear. The District of Columbia canceled liquor sales in advance for the first time since Prohibition. Major League Baseball canceled not one but two Washington Senators games for the march, the day of the march and the day after, a week ahead, figuring they'd still be cleaning up the mess.
So I never knew that.
People were terrified.
And listeners, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and the I Have a Dream speech in this conversation and again on the actual anniversary next Wednesday on our show. And let's make oral history a part of this. We want your memories of the March on Washington if you were there in person or even if you watched it on TV. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I suspect we do have some people listening right now who were there. Were you a kid? Did it open your eyes to something new? Were you a grown-up there to make a statement about something you already believed? 212-433-WNYC. Who were you there with? Was I Have a Dream the thing you remembered about the speech? What has the shorthand of media history downplayed or forgotten that you would like to say out loud as we remember that day and celebrate this 50th anniversary? 212-433-9692 for any of your memories of the March on Washington and I Have a Dream, August 28th, 1963. 212-433-9692 as we talk to Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of King and civil rights historian and author now of The King Years. Taylor, in a USA Weekend article you published just recently, you recalled how afterwards much of the media and political establishment reacted to King and the whole day with admiration and relief after all that negative anticipation that you were just describing. A, quote, Negro Gothic photo essay in Life magazine is one of the things you mentioned. Was that their term, Negro Gothic, or just how you describe
it? That's their term.
Which meant what to them at the time?
They even said that the photographs look like the famous Grant Wood painting. Essentially what they were saying.
American Gothic, the farmer and his wife, that thing?
Yeah, the farmer and his wife. Basically that we were scared of this march, but now we're relieved because they turned out to be just as nice as, as the farmers in the Grant Wood painting. So, yeah, there was tremendous relief after the march, and people, that's one of the reasons that it became so famous, is because people were relieved, they were admiring, and the I Have a Dream sequence said, my goodness, we were a little embarrassed that we were so frightened of a group of people who turned out to be so patriotic.
And how much do you think the tone of the march in that respect had an impact on the eventual passage of the civil rights legislation, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which obviously was the following year?
Well, it had considerable effect, but it wouldn't have done it alone. Really, the march itself was the product of demonstrations that had broken out all over the country after the dogs and fire hoses were loosed in Birmingham in May. and demonstrations broke out in over 700 cities, and really, in many respects, across the United States and even the world, broke down people's emotional distance and fear of doing something about segregation, which was very pervasive at that time. I mean, there was not a single public official between Texas and the Atlantic Ocean who advocated changing the segregation laws that were very strong in 17 states.
Maida in Madison, Madison, New Jersey. You're on WNYC.
Yes.
Hi, Maida.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was on the march 50 years ago. I went with my sister, Ellen Levine, whom you interviewed on another book she wrote, but Mr. Branch actually had very glowingly reviewed her book called Freedom's mm-hmm. Children, and I went with college friends, one of whom, Mary Liz Keough, whose uncle was Eugene Keough, the congressman. My memories of that day are, the most vivid memories are the diversity of people who were there, the diversity of clergy, the sense of being in a crowd but not being concerned about being in such a crowd, being crushed together, you know, hands sort of across your body, but such a sense of something that could be done, and the sense that carried back afterwards, and then, as Mr. Branch was just saying about the 64 Civil Rights Act, but then the Mississippi summer of 64 mm-hmm. and the struggles that continue, but now with the 50th anniversary, the sense of pride of having been a witness to history and maybe a participant.
Nicely said. Taylor, her memory of the diversity of the masses, was it true?
Yes. It was especially true against the past when people just assumed that you couldn't have large interracial crowds like that. And I myself, I grew up in Atlanta. At the time, I was the son of a dry cleaner in Atlanta. And any time there was any sort of racial crowd in the same room in a church, people got sweaty palms. So to have a big, because you didn't know what was going to happen, whether the police were going to come, whether the Klan was going to come, whether somebody's father was going to lose their business, the slightest people, it's hard to remember that for people who weren't alive, that the divisions were so great. And that's what made the march so vivid, because people came together often fearing great conflict because we were still in that period in history. And instead, there was a marvelous diversity and a wonderful spirit that if we tackle the divisions that divide us, we can accomplish great things. And we did.
Jeff in Kensington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I was 15 at the time of the march. I lived in the D.C. suburbs. And what he said about the fear was absolutely right. All these rumors about race riots, and my parents both told me, they forbade me to go down to the march. So I stayed home and watched it on TV. And then my father went to work. He worked for the federal government, and he took a two-hour lunch break and went to the march and came home. All he said, it was the greatest thing he was ever at. It was wonderful, and it's the last time I ever listened to my parents about going to a demonstration.
Great story. Oh, sorry. Did you want to finish that?
Well, I was just going to say, that evening I had tickets, actually, to hear Peter, Paul, and Mary at Carter Barron, which is the amphitheater in D.C., and uh-huh. heard them, though. And they were, like, still high from having been at the march, having sung at the march. They were, like, at this amazing level of higher than usual about their performance because of having been at the march, either that evening or the next evening. I don't remember.
Jeff, great memory. Thank you very much. But, Taylor, not everyone was so positive about what had happened there that day. As you wrote in USA Weekend, you remind us the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, called the speech demagogic, which I guess said more about Hoover than it did about King. And Hoover marked King as, quote, the most dangerous Negro of the future because of the I Have a Dream speech?
Exactly. This was the very next day. He said King's demagogic speech yesterday, after that, if not before, we must mark him as the most dangerous Negro in America from the standpoint of security, the Negro, and communism. That was a secret edict within the FBI. It more or less reflected J. Edgar Hoover's attitude. But in retrospect now, it's pretty sad commentary that somebody who had been a preeminent official in the U.S. government for over 40 years then could have such a jaundiced view of that day.
And you quote segregationist Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi, who said an astonishing and revealing thing on NBC, quote, the real goal of the conspiracy, he called the civil rights movement a conspiracy, is the concentration of all effective power in the central government in Washington, unquote. Can you tell us more about this rhetoric of conspiracy? And honestly, I was taken by how similar that quote was to what we still hear today. Obamacare is really about concentrating all power in Washington. The backlash to the Common Core curriculum from the right is about federal power. Opposition to the Defense of Marriage Act, about concentration of power in Washington. So does something tie together that era's rhetoric and today's?
Absolutely. Much of today's vocabulary was invented in reaction to the march. Governor Barnett of Mississippi said that in an NBC documentary. It's a great irony that he formulated this theory that that a biased media was in cahoots with King and unscrupulous politicians to promote this conspiracy on television. He accused the media of being biased to overcover the race issue and overemphasize it. And that George Wallace, very adroitly, who earlier in that year pledged segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, that's all he could talk about, was very astute after segregation was becoming no longer respectable, and he changed his whole tune from segregation to attacking what he called big government by pointy-headed bureaucrats and tyrannical judges and tax and spend legislators. So he invented a new vocabulary. He said, look, we're not going to talk about race anymore. It's favoritism. And in many respects, that kind of vocabulary we still have today from people who do not want to talk about race, but who are sending racial signals without using the actual words.
Carly on the Upper West Side, you were there 50 years ago?
I was indeed, and I remember Josephine Baker saying, there you are, white and black together, salt and pepper as you should be, and it was an honor to be a bit of a salt. And the power of the people, particularly the Southern black delegations, I was so impressed with their spirit. And then when I heard King, I just said, there's a prophet, and I said, who's that? And somebody said, King, and you know, I can't say any more. I was just blown away.
King and Josephine Baker. Carly, thanks a lot. We'll continue in a minute with Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning civil rights historian and biographer of Dr. King, his latest book called The King Years. And we're going to play a clip from the I Have a Dream speech that Taylor Branch wrote about recently that is not the I Have a Dream refrain. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we remember the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech and the greater context of the March on Washington 50 years ago next Wednesday with civil rights historian and King biographer Taylor Branch, and from you who were there, like Victor in Flushing. Victor, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. I remember strongly the impression of rolling into the city on the bus and the people welcoming us and cheering. I was a volunteer for a church group in Bedford-Stuyvesant in my early 20s, and I don't know when the lyric was actually written, but something along the lines of, it won't be long now, went through my head. And then much later in the day, I remember as the event, there were so many things going on that in some ways it was almost boring. And so I started walking forward just to see how far I could get. And I wound up at the steps of the monument just as Martin Luther King was introduced and stood mesmerized from that moment.
Great memory, Victor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Those are wonderful memories.
Now, Taylor, I've heard many times how King had used the I Have a Dream refrain in previous speeches, but it didn't become a big deal until the March on Washington speech. But I think you've written that King's prepared draft of the speech did not include I Have a Dream at all. Is that right?
Not one word of it, no. In fact, there was so much pressure to write a great speech that I think he gave in to it and wrote a very formal speech. It's not a bad one, but it's nothing like "I Have a Dream," which was one of his standard refrains that he had refined like a jazz musician on many occasions preaching earlier.
So he went off script? He went rogue from his own copy?
He went totally rogue. The whole everything that anybody remembers about the "I Have a Dream" speech was ad lib. And everything that people have forgotten was what he wrote and actually intended to say.
How about that? So let's play a clip from the speech that you have written poetically about. This is not the "I Have a Dream" refrain, but a riff on the line, "Let freedom ring." You want to set this up for us?
Yes. He wrote the formal speech, which was basically about how Negro black people had been given a blank check by the promise of equality in America, and he just could not deliver the conclusion of that, and he went off and did "I Have a Dream," and then he had another riff on "With This Faith We Go Forward," which was a preacher's riff, and the very final one was "Let Freedom Ring," and this is part of the "I Have a Dream," but it's the third of three refrains beginning with "I Have a Dream" that were all ad-libbed at the end of the speech.
Martin Luther King, August 28th, 1963.
Let freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Wow. Freedom ringing from Martin Luther King, a minute and a half worth from the March on Washington speech. I'm getting chills.
Yeah, it's very chilling for a number. First of all, he says "let freedom ring" 11 different times, just as he said "I Have a Dream" 9 different times with illustrations and "With This Faith" a number. But he says "let freedom ring," and a black man at a national march not only says "let freedom ring" in California and Colorado and New York, but he challenges it down in the bastions of white supremacy in Lookout Mountain, Stone Mountain, Georgia, where the Klan was reinvented in 1915, and in Mississippi. So it's very stirring. That is that is the conclusion. And to me, there are two significant things about it. Number one, the voice. Even apart from the words, there's a daring hope there, but there's also anguish that he knows how hard this is going to be. That's what makes his voice so striking, the tone of it. It's like a war in his voice between hope and a recognition that this is going to be hard. This is not a Pollyannish speech. There's a desperation and a determination in the voice that makes it stirring. The other thing that's really important about that conclusion in the light of history 50 years since is that the reaction commonly was that Dr. King gave such a patriotic speech that it was a relief to most white people that a black-led march was going to behave just like white people and be patriotic. But if you listen carefully to what he says at the very end, he says that when freedom is ringing, all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will sing a Negro spiritual born from slavery, free at last. So instead of saying that promising that all black people are going to behave like white people. He's inviting, saying that real freedom is when we can all take inspiration from what the slaves did in the spirituals, and that we can all take part in each other's cultures across the boundaries that divide us. So it's a remarkably inspiring and prophetic speech.
You bet. White and black, Jews and Gentiles, all of that. And as it came to be known as the I Have a Dream speech, I guess it could have come to be known as the Let Freedom Ring speech. Is it true, the story they tell, that Mahalia Jackson was standing behind King and saying, tell him about the dream?
Yes, it is. It is not definitively true, and I equivocated slightly in my accounts of it in my history book. Nobody knows whether her remarks were what actually made King ad-lib and go off script. But she had heard him give the I Have a Dream speech in Chicago just a week before. He had also given a very similar I Have a Dream speech in Detroit in June. And at a number of other occasions. So, yes, she was there. I don't know, unfortunately, of course, I couldn't interview her. She had died about whether she thought maybe his speech wasn't going over and was trying to help him out. We do know where his conclusion, where he broke off his speech and the line, he did not deliver any of the conclusion beginning with the line that began his conclusion. And in a way, you can see why. The line that he couldn't bring himself to say was, and so today let us go back to our communities as members of the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Dissatisfaction. That's what he wrote.
That's the I Have a Bureaucracy
he
speech.
He came up on that line and couldn't do it. And instead he said, let's don't wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you, my friends, today, and so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, he's kind of trying to figure out what to do, and he says, I still have a dream. And he begins the I Have a Dream speech with Mahalia prompting him in the background. Nobody knows whether she's what made him do it or whether just his he was a classical orator above all else, and he had been reading audiences for a long time.
And he probably read them.
Very well have sensed that what he had written to deliver as the ending wouldn't work, and he knew that I Have a Dream probably would.
Melanie in Branford, Connecticut.
We should all be grateful that he did ad-lib.
Melanie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hello. I actually heard I Have a Dream speech delivered by Martin Luther King in Durban, South Africa in 1966. Of course not in person. It was the darkest, darkest days of apartheid. There would be no way he would have been allowed into the country. But speaking to the point of how he broke down ethnic borders and whatever else, he certainly spread across geographic borders. It was absolutely astounding for us because just about every single leader or opponent to apartheid had been banned, which meant we could not read or hear them speak. We couldn't even see pictures of their faces. And the meeting was actually the National Union of South African Students, which was considered a communist organization by the government. Of course, it wasn't. And that same year, the student body invited Robert Kennedy to deliver the Day of Affirmation speech. It was a speech trying to bring back academic freedom, some of the words of which are on his grave today. And the leader at the time of MUSAS was banned as well because he embarrassed the government so.
Melanie, when you say you heard Martin Luther King deliver the I Have a Dream speech in South Africa, but he couldn't go there, was he speaking to South Africa from outside the country, or it was just that speech? It really had to do with the United States, but you all took inspiration from it.
Absolutely the latter. Somehow or other, a recording, it was like a long playing record in those days, had been smuggled in. And MUSAS played it at its meeting, risking goodness knows what, but of course it was worth it. And interestingly enough, I discovered subsequently that Steve Biko had just started at Natal University, of course, the black university, and he was at that very meeting, so he must have heard the speech as well. And one other little interesting point is that after the president of USAS was banned, the subsequent president later became the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, Margaret Marshall. And she was the one who wrote the opinion striking down the ban against same-sex marriage.
How about that? What goes around comes around. Melanie, thank you so much. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. We will do another segment on this on the actual anniversary and take more of your reminiscences next Wednesday. Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of King and civil rights historian. His latest book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. I guess you're in high season. You'll be busy the next 5 days, huh?
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it, and I love listening to all your listeners, including the one who showed how the spirit of that march went all around the world.
Thank you so much, Taylor Branch.
Thank you.
Young man, you too young to pray. Thank God I'm out of PLA. I'm too young to pray. I ain't too young to die. Thank God I'm out of PLA. Oh, PLA.